Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
Welcome to Inside Asia. I'm Steve Stein, and in this episode, we focus on the utopian side of artificial intelligence. It's not a subject you hear much about these days, and this program is no exception. Recent guests have spoken of AI's many torrid applications. It's been called our final invention. Its reach is ubiquitous and its victims many. No one is safe. Hospital patients, titans of industry, social media junkies, and yes, even small children. Want to learn how corporates are exposed to the deep web? How foreign governments manipulate data to alter our beliefs? How prime ministers' healthcare records are exposed? We have it all here on Inside Asia, stories that call out the jagged, dehumanizing edge of artificial intelligence. But like most things, there's another side, a kinder, gentler side. In this episode, we speak of AI's better angels. We look at how AI can be leveraged for good to solve big problems, bring people together, and even raise human consciousness. Or at least that's what my guest this episode believes. Let me introduce you to Anurag Banerjee. He's founder and CEO of Quilt.ai, a Singapore-based startup designed, and I quote, to create empathy to scale between organizations and the billions of people on the planet. I started there by asking him what empathy at scale actually means.
Our take on it is twofold. One is that we think that technology is fundamentally fragmented humanity. And this is true of any subway, any bus, any plane. We're immersed in our phones. And there's enough of a backlash now. And we're reading about even top Silicon Valley executives not allowing technology for their children because they understand the dopamine-inducing effects of that. So one, there's fragmentation around there's silos that are built. So at Quilt, the idea is, can we stitch these fragments together and embed humanity back into that?
How do you mean fragments? Like, you mean we're only addressing little singular issues, and therefore it's not spread across the experience, and you're looking to kind of broaden that experience through technology?
Some of it, yes, but more of, so I'll give you a different story. My daughter asked me the other day about a year ago what this new startup would do. And my point to her was, I asked her who her best friend was. And she said, this is a girl called Sienna. And so I said, okay, what do you know about Sienna? And she said, I know everything about her. And my glib but honest response was, well, daddy's startup intends to see if everyone can know everything about everybody. And Steve, you and I may not agree on many things, but if I always know where you're coming from, and I think there's a breakdown in civility of discourse. There's a breakdown in argument without judgment. And if we can bridge that gap in a fundamental way, then that's the intent. The intent isn't about, can I create a seamless experience for a marketing brand? That we do some of that work. The intent is more about me just understanding you better, like we're doing right now, chatting.
Well, this is, I guess, the issue, the fear that arises with people. Given Facebook's recent privacy atrocities and some of the things that are happening with the Russians meddling in U.S. elections, and media companies and advertising agencies exploiting and using and manipulating data to kind of get a different result or shape people's behaviors, there is reasonable fear that the more one knows about another through digital analysis, the more vulnerable and susceptible people are to exploitation. How do you address that?
I think the idea is that if you, I always know every, so the way digital technology works today is you are being followed, I am being followed by different pieces of technology.
We can't change that, it's done.
Right, exactly. We can't change that. What we can change is, should this be given in an individualized format or tightly aggregated but anonymized format? And so all the work that we do has no individual attached to it. Mm. If I'm seeking to understand why somebody likes Pakuraban or somebody likes a particular watch or somebody is deeply misogynistic, I never want it traced back to that individual, but in a tight cohort so where we can take actions in a meaningful way, but still in an anonymized, respecting the individual way.
So you're analyzing individual data, but then arriving at group practices and behaviors in order to then reshape or condition, if you will, the way people engage in the world.
Yes, I'll give you a simple example. A lot of our application is in the market research space. So historically, market research has been done by say, folks like us, sitting around a table asking people, well, what do you think about this particular color or shade or shirt or feel of the bed sheet? Or it's a survey, right? Yeah, yeah. And then that knowledge, if you will, is taken and distributed with great precision using technologies such as a Facebook or a Google or even TV and other ad platforms. So there's precision in the delivery, but we feel that there is imprecision or a very generic feel to the front end of it in terms of understanding the person.
And that's by virtue of the fact that these are small sample sets and not large mass data sets. So therefore, you're not really sure if you're comprehensively capturing what the issues are.
Very true. And there's enough, I think there's a large industry that's been built around the idea that a certain sample set meaningfully extrapolates to the truth. I struggle with that. How can 1,000 people represent what the US thinks? And you can mathematically try and convince me of that. And there's a large school of thought on that. But it just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, your company, you know, you're very explicit about this in positioning Quilt.ai, where you're saying you want to be able to staff your organization with both anthropologists, technologists, data scientists, look at certain situations and try to figure out whether or not with your problem-solving skills, you can help resolve issues that, you know, are in the world that are getting in the way of people's ability to advance themselves. And I mean, advance themselves culturally and socially, not so much financially or career-wise. Can you give a couple of examples of why and how you do this so that our listeners can start to understand the kind of work you do?
Sure. So I'll give you two examples, a commercial example, both are commercial, but one would be a conventional research example, one would be an ambitious example. But to go back to the point that you made about our team, it's sensibly curated. It's roughly half engineers and half anthropologists and human researchers. And the intent is that the technology, that everything in technology is considered homogenous. So you tweet and I tweet, and most people think it's two tweets. But you're very different than I am. Your life experiences are different. Texturally, you're different. Even if we were identical, the moment in time that you tweeted and what was in your head is different than what's in my head. And anthropologists and human researchers have done a lot of work on this at small scale in terms of understanding people better. I'm trying to bridge information at scale. If I can look at petabytes of data and convert them with a human lens, then it gives you a different view than a tweet or a review, because those are not metrics to me.
Okay.
Having said that, to answer your question around the way we take this to market and work, we help, we work only on a referral basis, firstly. And the way it works is we take a complicated problem that a CEO or a CMO might have. And that might be, I'm struggling to understand why my consumers are doing this. And in the olden days, they would have commissioned research that would have taken them 3 months. And they have spoken to 300, 400, maybe 1,000 consumers, and they'd come up with a hypothesis. Today, we give them literally in 48 hours a glimpse into the life of that consumer with all its flaws, inaccuracies, and almost and with no bias from our side. Just we present the data humanly interpreted, but from a truthful manner. The other side is
can you give one just example of that, a live example of how, you know, what problem was presented to you and then how you actually worked through it and presented an insight?
Sure. So we did work recently for a very large retail organization, e-commerce retail organization. And the challenge they had was they weren't selling phones online. And data, as most competent digital organizations that analyzed everything that happens from the time Steve comes into their website, the pages he sees, what he looks at, but he wasn't adding the phone to their cart and then buying it eventually. And so they knew what was happening, but they didn't know why Steve wasn't buying the phone despite competitive pricing, brand availability, all the right things were there. We listened, we did something counterintuitive. We listened to conversations that were taking place offline on social media, on search and other blogs and other forums around people buying phones, and
generally,
just generally, yeah. there was no hypothesis, and that's part of our work. There's no hypothesis; the data informs us. So, as much as possible, we are walking in there with no bias.
So, do you establish a demographic like there, or you're just like generally looking for any signal of people talking, sharing insights about buying a mobile phone online, and then basically letting the big data crunch occur?
Yes, the latter, exactly. Yeah. So there's no demographic or psychographic or location bias happening on that. Okay. And the insight that we found was that in rural parts of the world, people like to still have their contacts transferred over, right?
Their contacts.
So you and I live on the cloud, and when you get a new phone, we seamlessly sync up and off we go. But the person buying their second Android phone still has about 300-400 people in their first Android phone contacts. Mm. They've got to get those physically transferred over. And if you remember from 20 years ago when he first did it, it was a pain, right?
Yeah, still is for me. Maybe for others, they've got it, but I understand. Yeah.
So, and that's the point. Yeah. So that was the insight that we got, and it wasn't statistically significant. Yeah. It wasn't. It wouldn't stand up in the court of math, but humanly you understood that that was a huge problem. And so now this large retail giant is saying, well, when you buy phones online, the guy who delivers them to you will transfer your contacts over.
Oh, so that was the solution. Now they have a service to address that concern. And have they seen the results?
Yes. So I can't share the sales lift, but it's significant.
Okay.
Significant enough for them to give us more follow-on work.
This is Inside Asia. My guest is Anurag Banerjee, founder and CEO of Quilt.ai, an early-stage tech and consulting firm that merges machine learning with human and cultural intelligence to create insight for good and for profit. In a moment, the second half of this fascinating conversation. I'm Steve Stein, and my guest is Anurag Banerjee, founder of Quilt.ai. In the second part of our conversation, I follow up on a comment he made earlier about how Quilt.ai picks its projects. The firm is unapologetically for profit, but a percentage of the company's time and resources are set aside to address not-for-profit challenges, or what he best describes as projects in the interest of humanity. I ask why he and his partners take on that kind of work and invite him to share concrete examples of how Quilt.ai designs and delivers results to solve problems that plague humanity.
Why we choose to do that?
Aren't you in the business of making money? I mean, I thought, I don't know. I mean, is this, that's my generation. What does your generation think about this?
I'm not that far away. I like money as much as the next person. Don't get me wrong. But the idea is I think I'll do this for the next 40 years. And a lot of companies have put out these very bold and progressive statements around a 1,000-year company. And I can't see that far. I'm limited. But I can see the next 40 years to a certain extent. I'm 45 now. So I think this is what I want to do. So the idea is, if this is what I want to do, then I'll try and use this vehicle to both make a little bit of money, but also drive impact. And so I'll give you, so the company has a 60-40 bias in terms of commercial and non-commercial, and we hope it'll flip at some point in time. But the 40 is broken up equally into two halves. One half is where, and I mean this in terms of the amount of time we spend on work. And the 20% that, there are two 20s. One is around paid work for a foundation or an NGO or a charity or a bilateral or multilateral agency. The next 20 is just experiments. We don't have to be Google to think about moonshots, right? We can use the limited resources we have to try and solve a problem. So I'll give you an example in both cases. In the first, the paid case, we've done about 9 or 10 different projects in this space right now. And they're typically around finding out about, so one project is around girls in lower socioeconomic classes. And there's a lot of work done. If these kids become pregnant, then their life spirals out of control. And there's evidenced by, enough research on that. So we've helped organizations figure out what kind of content should these girls be given in a non-preachy, natively integrated manner to delay pregnancy or avoid pregnancy in their teens.
To help people adapt or adjust their behaviors to avoid pregnancy. Is that what you mean?
Yes. So the first step is understanding where these girls live in a digital world. What do they do? What do they understand? What content do they consume? And any content that's aimed at changing their behavior by these NGOs and charitable organizations can only work if they understand the ecosystem that the girls live in. Mm. So we mapped the entire ecosystem. We created areas of vulnerability. We created areas of opportunity where the content should lie, what kind of content should be there, what should be the tone of it, etc. And we did this by, we looked at, almost 500,000 girls and understood their ecosystem.
And then applied and said, if you adjust the language in this, that way, we actually may get a better result and see a reduction in early or premarital pregnancies. Yes. Is that right?
If you create content that ties into their ecosystem in this particular way, with this tonality, then it should result in lower pregnancy.
So immediately, I start to think, in the wrong hands, that information can be exploited to not necessarily work to the benefit of these young girls. What's your rule and what's your guarantee that that information won't fall into the wrong hands to somebody with a commercial agenda?
Sure. So three, four different ways. One is we never keep individual information. We will never say that these kids in this part of Bombay or outside Jakarta were the people. And so there's no names, no individual, or PII, as they say in the banking world. That's one.
So that addresses the individual privacy issue.
Yes. The second is from a commercialization perspective. I don't know how I would respond if somebody gave me $1 billion, right? I haven't seen that number, so I don't know, and I'm being transparent about it. But I haven't seen a number that's large enough to make me think whether we should do that or not. And the third is we've had several organizations come to us, commercial, that have wanted to sell to kids. And we just take a hard stand on it and say, nothing below the age of 18, we won't do a commercial project unless it's what we deem as an adult in terms of who we're studying and understanding.
But why, there are products out, not all commercial products are bad for kids. Kids are a reasonable demographic. They clearly have influence over their parents. If it's an organization with a product or a service which would be meaningful and important and beneficial to kids, why would you block yourself or take yourself out of that space?
If it's important and meaningful and beneficial, which is the kind of work we've done, if I had to use that phrase, but if it's and they're great, so I'm a big fan of Lego and other such commercially sensible organizations, I feel there's enough work for us to do without doing that work.
Okay. You just feel that there's a little bit of a danger in wandering into that field and perhaps your results being applied in ways that you hadn't anticipated?
That, and I'm biased towards a simple childhood. I'm biased towards trees and farms. And that's, and as idyllic as that sounds, that was core to the way I grew up. And as long as I can give it to enough kids, I think that's a good outcome.
If I'm coming back to this, please forgive me, but it's almost like I keep thinking of your evil twin out there somewhere, right? Who's going to somehow, have a different take on this, because you are applying your own ethical view about where data can reasonably and ethically be applied. But there might be somebody living in another part of the world who has a similar kind of agenda, but he or she feels that, no, I have a different moral outlook, and I believe that it should be this way versus that way. How do you feel about these things? Because it sounds like in the hands of certain people, this data is a powerful force, and we know this is true. Everyone's talking about it. Data is bigger than, ballistic missiles in some ways. It's that powerful. How do you grapple with this day to day, and how do you address this when shareholders and others come to you and say, what are your criteria for managing, working, and preserving the sanctity of the data?
So there's no doubt that this data is being misused. Well, misused is my point of view, but this data is being used for doing things that I don't agree with. Mm-hmm. I can't change that, right? But this data isn't being used, and this is our mission. This data is not being used by organizations that could use it to have more impact. Mm-hmm. And if we play in that space, it's a good counterweight. Mm-hmm. Have we had offers to use data for less than ideal means? Of course you've had. And you hope your North Star holds. And it's easy to sound preachy and say my North Star will always hold. For now, my North Star is holding, and I think we'll we'll end up building an interesting company and interesting organization. And even the way we evaluate projects coming in, right? So, there's a lot of side note, a lot of conversation around growth and technology and stocks, but four of the five largest stock gains in the last 15 years have been tobacco companies. We got a brief the other day for a tobacco company, and part of me wanted to say, yes, we'll take it. We'll charge them 100x what we should charge anybody else. And he said, no, let's not go there. So do we grapple with it? Yes. And that's, I think, the human thing to do. But I think we have a moral imperative in some ways, and that allows us to attract talent in an interesting way, right? All the colleagues who've come, we've had these deep conversations about what cause they care about. So we've had people, we have causes that we care about. The last 20% around stunting, around suicide, around misogyny, around gender equity, around orphanages. And so we give time, money. We also donate 5% of our monthly revenue, not profit, to a charity of an employee's choice. So there's a large amount of work that goes into that. We just did a fascinating piece of work on suicide.
So tell us about that.
Sure. Suicide, mental health is probably the largest, and there's math around it and data and statistics, but it is a large issue. It's pervasive. I read something very disturbing earlier this morning about 8 being the age when a woman's self-esteem peaks. My daughter's 8 this year, so it's I struggle with that. But to go back to suicide, when somebody commits suicide, a lot of people say, oh, I didn't know Anurag was suicidal. Like, where did that come from? And so we looked at almost 50 celebrities who committed suicide in the last 2 years. We looked at what they said online. We looked at the photographs they posted. And we found these two really disturbing trends. And the machine found them. Like, humanly, it's hard to analyze that at scale. If you look at their photographs, Steve, from 2 years ago to the time before they committed suicide, the color, the richness of the color leaves the photograph. So if you look at a photo...
The color of what? Their skin? The color of their...
Of the photographs they were posting.
The color shifted.
Yes.
So they were drawn to posting...
Just dim, gray, neutral, as if the life was sucked out of the photograph.
Oh, how interesting.
Yes. And you can't tell that humanly, because if you just look at one of them in individuality, you might say, oh, that's a great Instagram photo. That's awesome. It's very beautiful. But if you look at the sequence of it, right, consistently across all of these people, across tens of thousands of photos to find that pattern where everything goes to this dim, lifeless gray, that's challenging. And so we're going to try and do more work. This was not paid. We did this because we want to do it. The other...
So you discovered that you had this discovery,
yes.
And then with that, then you create almost a flagging mechanism to say that if you are concerned about a child or somebody or a friend who may be prone to depression or, you know, to determine whether or not, or to basically circumvent the possibility of a suicide or an attempt on one's life, you then intervene. How does this work? How does this play out?
I'll give you one more fact on that before I answer the question. Yeah. And the other fact was that the amplitude. So nobody went from saying, I'm really happy to I'm really sad. Okay. They just went blah.
Flat.
It was flat. It was as if the emotion was sucked out of them. So to answer your question, we haven't done enough work on this as yet. Mm-hmm. We want to find a sponsor that'll sponsor this work so we can do it at scale. We can understand depression in Japan versus the US versus India versus the UK and see if there are trends, differences of... Because today when you're sad and you go onto Google or Twitter and say, I want to kill myself, Google and Twitter give you this hard-coded answer saying, call this number, sounds like you're depressed, right? And there's it's awesome, but we feel it's not enough.
Yeah.
And we don't know enough about how to create interventions. But if the data is available and we're in the data business, I'd like to give it to people who are in that space, who can, and success here doesn't look like 50 million people saved, which would be great. It's like 1 or 2 or 5 or 10. Yeah. And so it's a journey. I think if you check back in a year, I'd love to have made progress around being able to give data that people could use to intervene, again, without violating privacy norms. And that's, again, do I want to be contacted when I'm suicidal? I don't know.
Okay, evil twin Anurag, other side of the world. Let's think about this whole thing. It's Minority Report, pre-crime unit, and we're looking for people who are potential killers, and we're going to analyze their behavior or analyze general behavior in order to figure out if there's certain people we shouldn't start monitoring, shadowing, and possibly intervening with. How do you feel about that?
So,
Not to put you on the spot, but how do you feel about that? Or do you talk to your evil twin?
We haven't spoken today. but it's happening in some shape or form. I think there's if you assume, and I always assume that people have good intentions. So let's leave my evil twin alone for a second. But I think good governments, most governments, good organizations care about understanding people better. And that's the hypothesis I'm going with. To that extent, should somebody be monitored or be under surveillance, I worry a lot about that. And should that surveillance and data be collected at an individual level, I worry a lot about that. Is it being collected? Absolutely. Is it being analyzed? Of course. You know, there's a show on Netflix, Black Mirror. That reality is we've gone beyond that. The level of surveillance and information is much higher, more sophisticated. And a lot of it is, I'm sure, being used for good. So I think we should, is there an evil twin? I'm sure there is. Are there organizations making registries of people of particular type? Of course.
I don't want to step on your optimism here. But you know, you look at the political trends around the world and you see, you know, authoritarianism rising and democracies falling. You see behaviors by governments which aren't necessarily always in the interest of their people. And you start to think about levels of competition and xenophobia that are creeping up. And as much as I, like you, would like to believe in the innate goodness of man, I'm not entirely convinced that governments are always putting their dollars against those initiatives. I get the feeling they're more looking on applying their dollars to throw up the safeguards against their people. And sometimes that data can be skewed in the interest of their interest versus the interest of the individuals or people live outside of that country. I know that's a big, you know, it's 8:30 in the morning here and I don't want to be killing us on this, but this is a fascinating point you're making because it really is who owns this data? How can I control my own destiny? How can I avoid being, you know, manipulated without even knowing I'm being manipulated?
Well, so I'll give you a simple example to tone it down first, but and then we'll go into the authoritarianism. My first job in New York, I ended up at a bar on a Friday that week, and I walked in, I had a beer. It was, I think, $2.50. I had three of them, and I tipped, I think, $5, and I walked out. And there's a great conversation around the Red Sox, which is my baseball team. No judgment there. This is before the World Series.
How about that evil twin? Yeah.
And then I walked back the next week, yeah. and I had a beer, and I'd forgotten my wallet, right? But it was just, the guy knew that I liked IPAs, and this is before IPAs became cool. And so we had this affinity, right? So I'd given up some of my privacy, so he knew something about me. Yeah. But he provided me value. And I think there's this value-privacy continuum on data, right?
Yeah. So and you can say he gave you a free beer, but I'm going to say because you're a good tipper. I don't know. But he knew something about it. You're saying there's a personal connection between, which therefore allowed you to then have some positioning with him that otherwise you would not have had. Now you're extrapolating and said data can do that as long as it's not tagged to individuals. It's indicators for human interaction, human exchange.
Exactly. Think about it wasn't a free beer. It was just that he remembered that I liked an IPA, right? Okay. It was that, and it was beautiful. I walked in and he's like, hey, dude. And he slid an IPA across to me and I was just touched. And I'm talking about it 18 years later, which is, you know, it's stayed with me clear and I've been back to the bar multiple times. But, and that's the point. Like, we want, eventually everyone wants to feel special. You and me, we walk in here, we get a coffee, and if they remember that I like a piccolo, that's just nice, right? But that niceness at scale is delivered through data that we are giving up bits of our privacy to get. Mm. So there's a value privacy continuum, and it swings, and people have opinions one way or the other on that. But the truth is, you can't get customized value if you don't give up some privacy.
This is Inside Asia. You've been listening to my conversation with Anurag Banerjee, founder and CEO at Quilt.ai, a deep tech and advisory firm that merges machine learning with human and cultural intelligence to create empathy at scale. As always, I end each program with an Asia Insider Minute, where I do my best to sum up the key takeaways from the conversation you've just heard. I also ask a few additional questions of my own and ask you, the listener, to share your thoughts as well. At the close of this conversation, I find myself wanting desperately to believe that AI can cure our most complex social and cultural challenges. I want more than anything to worship at the altar of AI altruism, to have faith that in the hands of decent and right-minded people, big data, machine learning, and benevolent algorithms can and will emerge as the superheroes of our day. Quilt.ai appears to be stepping into that curious and hopeful space of social enterprise that believes profit and compassion are not mutually exclusive. In the case of this young company, empathy at scale means leveraging big data in new and philanthropic ways to decipher the things that ail us, and in so doing, then build a solution to right the wrong. Nothing is free, however, and in this case, we sacrifice privacy for insights that could change our world. What I found so intriguing in my conversation with Anurag was the accent on humanism that appears to have wilted in recent years, in part from the deployment of new technology and in part from the social and political backlash provoked, curiously enough, by that technology. It was supposed to unite us, open billions of windows of cultural exchange, create new virtual meeting places, allow for the thoughtful exchange of ideas, and to some degree it has. And yet, study after study shows that people are feeling more isolated and less connected now than ever before. Could it be that technology is our modern-day Midas curse? We use it to preserve what we covet, but misuse it and it kills the things we love most. If this indeed is the case, then we should heed the Anurag prophecy. He ranks among the tech faithful and still believes that technology, powered by AI, can connect us and solve society's biggest problems. Our machines know us. They know what we want before we do. That's a boon for any organization with something to sell, but what about the ability to save someone's life, intervene in a crisis, prevent a terrorist attack, or slow the rate of suicides? All worthy causes, and until recently, out of reach in the absence of less sophisticated means. There's still the thorny question of who owns and controls the data. For now, social media behemoths like Google, Facebook, Tencent, and Baidu reign. No doubt they will come under added scrutiny as details of data manipulation and misuse continue to surface. And of course, we still have governments, some benevolent and some not, that see data as a means of monitoring and in some cases controlling their people. How odd and ironic it would be if in the not-too-distant future, it will be the thousands of startups spread around the world that decide and act on big data to solve the problems that companies and countries can't or won't. Are we seeing the makings of a modern-day David and Goliath tale? Will large corporations with profit-hungry shareholders go toe-to-toe with tiny startups wielding AI slingshots? That depends on your mindset and whether you see the future as utopian or dystopian. Me? Well, I'm on the fence. How about you? Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.